G'day, Indy Wood is my name. You're listening to the Local Update podcast, looking at local issues, events and personalities from around the Bega Valley. On today's episode, well, with COVID restrictions easing somewhat around the country, the Bega Pioneers Museum is returning to full operation, opening Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays and Saturdays here in Bega. We'll catch up with the Bega Historical Society's president, Mr. Peter Rogers, later in the program. Here on the Local Update. My name's Indy Wood. You are listening to The Local Update, a podcast looking at local issues, events and personalities from around the Bega Valley. And up first, as we do every week, we'll catch up with local historian and personality from around the Bega Valley, Graham Farram. This week, Graham is tying up loose ends. Over the last few weeks, you've learnt about the history of newspapers in the Bega Valley and the history of the Bega Primary School. And this week, we learn about the Welby family and tie it all up in a neat little bow.
I've been looking at the early history of the Bega District News from its foundation as the Bega Gazette under Robert Sharp. A couple of blokes took it over for just a little while, didn't make much of a mark, and then William Henry Brain bought the newspaper. He'd just retired as the headmaster at the Bega Primary School, and I'd been interested that both he and the gentleman who followed him in about 4 years' time as editor of the Bega Gazette had both been teachers at the Bega Public School, which was founded in 1861. So Brain was about the third teacher there. They'd had a couple of people who hadn't been able to do much. He stopped there for 4 years and 4 months and was a little bit dissatisfied. So he bought the paper off Robert Sharp, and he was there for about 4 years. And then it went into the hands of Mr. Oswald Welby. And that struck me as interesting. Two teachers succeed each other, and then two editors succeed each other. And I didn't quite know what the story was, but I knew that there had been some rumours going about the museum a little while ago, and it could have been when this book was actually being compiled. They made this valley home, stories of the pioneer women who helped build the Bega Valley, as told by Sandra Florence and Diane Pryor. Now, this book is available at the museum, and we have reopened now. I've also been able to look at the history of Bega by William Bailey, and I'll come back to that again. And I've also been looking at the history of the Bega Primary School, 1860 to 2010, by Claire Lupton. And they've all proved rather interesting. But this story, I was working on something else, and then I ran across this biography. I think it's the second last one in the book. It's in alphabetical order. This is Mrs. Lily Welby, ex-Wilmot, née Bogie. The first proven reference we can find to Margaretta Eliza Elizabeth Lillian Bogie is the 1851 UK census, where she is found as Margaretta E. Bogie, aged 18, born 1833, at Liverpool, Lancashire. She was residing at 7 Providence Place, Llandaff, Glamorganshire, Wales, with her father, James W. William Bogie, aged 51, bookkeeper to timber merchants, her brother, Charles K. Bogie, and a servant, Mary Coslett. Lily, as she was known, was shown as housekeeper. Lily's father, James, had married a mother, Anne Taylor, at Liverpool on the 9th of January, 1824. The next reference to Lily is her marriage in the December quarter of 1853 at Cardiff, Glamorganshire, to widower Wallace Robinson Wilmot, County Road Surveyor. Wallace's first wife, Jane, had passed away in April of that year. In the September quarter of 1854, Lily gave birth to their daughter, Lillian Bogie Wilmot, at Merthyr Tydfil, Glamorganshire. All these things have references, which I'll run through later. The family then went to India, where in 1855, Wallace was found as a civil engineer employed by the East India Company in Bengal. On the 9th of March, 1859, Wallace passed away and was buried the same day at Lahore, Bengal, leaving Lily a widow with a young child to support in a far and foreign land. Lily was not alone for too long. The British community in India was a close-knit one, and no doubt Lily would have known teacher Oswald Welby. Oswald was a widower with a young daughter, Louisa Helen Oswald Welby. Oswald's wife, Margaret, had passed away at Lahore on the 20th of September, 1858. Lily and Oswald were married at Calcutta, Bengal, India, on the 20th of July, 1859. With the loss of both their spouses in India, it appears that Lily and Oswald and their girls were looking to new horizons. Although records still have to be verified, it appears that Lily, Oswald, and Lillian came to Australia by the Cambodia in October 1859, followed in November 1860 by 10-year-old Louisa on the result. Now, I've found a reference to another Welby who was in our neck of the world, so maybe Louisa travelled with her. They didn't stay very long in Australia. According to the Nelson Examiner and New Zealand Chronicle of the 29th of December 1860, a Mr. and Mrs. Welby and two children arrived in New Zealand from Sydney to the IRM steamer Prince Albert. Both Lily and Oswald placed advertisements in the Nelson Examiner and New Zealand Chronicle from the 2nd of November 1861 to the 12th of April 1862. Mrs. Oswald will be happy to receive pupils for instruction on the pianoforte. Terms can be ascertained on application to Mrs. Welby at her residence, Brook Street. Mr. Oswald Welby, who has resided for many years on the continent, having formed a class for modern languages, will receive pupils for instruction in French, Italian, and German. Terms and hours of attendance can be ascertained on application to Mr. Welby, Brook Street, Nelson. After their sojourn in New Zealand, the Welby family returned to Australia. From newspaper items on Trove, we find that Oswald Welby is a member of the Goulburn Volunteer Rifles from 1865 to 1869. The family then seems to move to Bega, where we find Oswald in 1851 as headmaster of Bega Public School, replacing W.H. Brain in that position. Whilst Oswald was busy with duties as headmaster, Lily pursued her great love of music. Numerous newspaper articles of the time referred to her prowess and her efforts to bring culture to the town. The Town and Country Journal of 11 November 1871 wrote, "Mrs. Welby is a lady who is untiring in her efforts to keep up an elevated tone of society by the cultivation of high art and a taste for good music. She gave her time to coach singers and musicians for the shows she produced." A later newspaper article stated, "Mrs. Welby is even now affectionately remembered by numbers of her music pupils. She was a great musical enthusiast and succeeded in getting many noted artists to visit Bega. The Cavendini Concert Company came at her bidding, bringing with them that wonderful tenor of past days, Mr. Arnaz Beaumont." Lily was also a great fundraiser, using her musical talent to organise concerts and festivals to raise money for the betterment of Bega. Another item from the Town and Country Journal of the 29th of December 1877 reads, Church of England. The new organ is now up and has been played by Mrs. Welby on several occasions. It is a very nice instrument and fills the new church well. This beautiful instrument has been obtained only through the never-failing energy of the good lady above mentioned. Mrs. Welby has used every effort to raise the money, and I'm very happy to say she has succeeded. The instrument costs £160 or thereabouts. Lily gave a concert in April 1878 to raise money to buy a piano for the new School of Arts. And in January 1880, HMAS Pinafore was performed in Bega, less than 2 years after it was first performed in London. And she was responsible for organising that successful performance, raising £51.12 for the School of Arts. Oswald and Lily welcomed the marriage of his daughter Louisa to Bega's hard-working doctor, Montague Evershed, on the 20th of April, 1876, and stayed in Bega long enough to enjoy three of the five grandchildren born in Bega before having to leave. A veiled criticism was made by the editor of the Bega Gazette, W.H. Brain, whom Oswald had replaced at the school, about Oswald's inefficient teaching practices. Oswald sued W.H. Brain for libel, claiming £200 damages in Bega Court in November 1874. Brain was not able to pay Oswald the damages sought, so Oswald took over as editor of the Gazette in lieu of payment. Life must have been quite busy for the Welbys in Bega. But it seemed that the urge to explore new horizons again took hold, and in late 1883, Oswald took over as headmaster of the Balmain Academy, Darling Road, Balmain, from the then headmistress, Mrs. Duna. The academy had formerly been known as Brussels College. Lily, as usual, gave lessons in singing, pianoforte, and organ. Unfortunately, their newfound endeavour was not to last very long. On the 6th of April, 1883, Oswald passed away at their home, Brussels, from inflammation of the lungs, aged 68, so not so very old. Lily Welby took over the running of the Balmain Academy with the assistance of Mr. Walter Worthington Criddle as headmaster, and her daughter Lillian in charge of the preparatory division. A sad time was lightened when, on the 7th of January 1885, Lily's daughter Lillian married the new headmaster, Walter Criddle. Then, in 1886, Lillian presented Lily with a granddaughter, Lily Louisa H.M. Criddle. I found here, on page 112, an advertisement that says it ran in the Bega Standard in 1883. Balmain Academy. On the heights of Balmain. High-class school for boys and girls. Girls received as day pupils only. Principal, Mrs. Welby. Assisted by resident and visiting masters. The school offers special advantages to boarders, being within 5 minutes' walk of good sea bathing. And delightfully and salubriously situated. The system of instruction is a combination of the best methods in public and private schools and comprises all the usual subjects, prospectus and references on application, vacancies for resident pupils. Fees commence from date of enrolment. Lily appears to have left the Balmain Academy as, from January 1886, newspaper advertisements show a new principal, Mr. J.H. Morrison, had taken over. Lily passed away on the 24th of October 1889 at her residence, 37 Tooton Street, Balmain. She and Oswald are buried at the Balmain Cemetery. Lily had certainly led a full life, born in Liverpool, travelling to Wales, then across the oceans to India, Australia, New Zealand, back to Australia, This talented, energetic, and untiring lady left her mark wherever she went, and the town of Bega certainly benefited from her being here. The references were England and Wales Free Birth, Death and Marriage Birth Index, the 1837 to 1915, the National Archives of the UK, the East India Company Records, India Deaths and Burials, 1719 to 1948, FamilySearch.org, India Deaths and Burials, 1919 to 1948, FamilySearch.org, and IGI, FamilySearch.org. There's also the biography of the daughter, Louisa, who married the good Dr. Evershed, for whom there is a clock tower on a corner of Carp and Gift Street in Bega. And of course, the school that I'm talking about is just down the road on the opposite side from the museum, and is a very fine building to look at. I'm going to talk more about the building and the builders at some other time, but I thought I really should get that little bit about Brain was not able to pay Oswald the damages for. So Oswald took over as editor of the Gazette in lieu of payment, and did about 4 years there before they moved on to Balmain, leaving one of the daughters behind. So next week I'm going to try to have a bit of a look at the commercial growth of Bega. Last week off mic, we'd been talking about how impressive the bank buildings are in Bega, and certainly these days, you know, with social isolation and restrictions, and nobody wanted to touch cash, which was ironic because during the fires, nobody could use plastic because they'd lost it all, and cash was king for a moment. So we'll talk about all of that next week, I hope.
Graham Farram is a long-term local, a member of Bega's Historical Society, and affiliated with the Bega Pioneers Museum. We catch up with him every week to look at what he's found from the history of the Bega Valley. When we first started doing this podcast, 3.5 months ago, Graham would present his address in the main foyer of the Bega Pioneers Museum every week with an audience in front of him. For the last 3 months, we haven't been able to do that because COVID restrictions have meant that the museum's been closed. So it was pleasing to learn this week that with COVID restrictions easing slightly, the museum has returned to its normal operations of being open Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. I thought I'd better find out a bit more about the museum, so I caught up this week with the president of the Bega Historical Society, Peter Rogers.
I retired here about 2003 and came down to the museum and said I was interested in helping, and the next thing I knew I had jobs galore, put on the committee, etc., etc. So,
but the Rogers family has a strong history in this community though, don't you? You're from this region?
Yes, actually I was born in Bombala, but I was born one of the Rogers, and they're an old name here in Bega. And my mother was a Parbury, another old name here in Bega. My mother and father got married in the Depression. My grandfather, Tommy Rogers, who was a very astute financier, found that the electricity supply company in Bombala was going broke. It was insolvent, in fact. So he went to the receivers and offered them a price for it. Bought it. It's in the meantime, my father had done his apprenticeship as an electrician in Sydney with Warburton and Frankie. So he and Mum were able to get married because they had a ready-made little business in Bombala to run. I was born up there in 1935. Worth Circus had come to town on the 31st of May 1935, and I decided to arrive that night. My mother had been looking forward to going to Worth Circus. It had come on its own special train to Bombala. It was the terminus of the railway at the time. So she always said I interrupted her viewing of the circus because I arrived about half an hour after midnight, thus becoming an April Fool.
You obviously got involved in the museum, though, because you had a strong interest in the history of this region. What drew you to it?
Well, partly because my family had deep roots in Bega, both my mother and my father. And at school, I discovered I always liked history, probably one of the lessons I enjoyed most of all. And I can remember coming home from school one day to tell my father about hearing about Sir Francis Drake, who I thought was a marvellous person, defeating the Spanish Armada. And my father said to me solemnly, I have been to the spot where Sir Francis Drake played bowls while the Spanish Armada was coming up the channel. And he said to his men, we've got at least 4 hours to wait before the Dons get here, and we'll have plenty of time to go out and defeat them. Let's finish the game of bowls. They were playing with cannonballs in those days, and the cannonballs were, by nature, their manufacture, somewhat out of round. And the bowls always had a bias, so you had to work out where your bowl was going to go to get to the pin. So that was the origin of the game of bowls, playing with cannonballs. Nowadays, the bowls, modern bowls, are made of plastic and they have an inbuilt bias, again, still likely to make it a more skillful game.
And a little bit less of a tendency to blow up, eh?
That's right, yeah.
Now, let's talk about this thing we've got in front of us here. It's got a saucepan lid on the top of it and then four sides to it. It looks like maybe it's one of those bug zapper things that you might hang up when you go camping. Or maybe some kind of lamp. So, what is it?
Well, that was one of the things that intrigued me when I joined the museum. Somebody showed me, and it is in fact a toaster. And it was made in the 50s or late, early 50s. And in South Africa, of all places, I've never seen one like it in Australia. And as you can see, it holds four slices of bread. By working this lever here, you pull them out in a position where you put the bread in. And then after the bread has been toasted on one side, you then swing the thing through its full arc and it reverses, doing four slices of bread.
So it's like it's got wings on it, hey? The wings swing out. Four wings swing out and you put the bread in, and then there's obviously an element in the middle and each of the four sides heat it, hey?
The element is in the middle and it glows red hot, of course, once the electricity is plugged in with this plug here. And you've got to watch the toast so that you don't burn it and then swing it round.
None of this popping up stuff like the modern things, eh?
The old wing toasters that I was used to in the early days just were two sides that flapped down. And they would do two slices at once. You still burnt the toast, of course.
Yes.
I grew up scraping toast into the sink. Yes. My father showed me. In fact, he even told me it was good for me, the charcoal on the toast, so not to worry about it too much.
Well, I was born in the 80s, and we had one of those toasters when I was young too, so...
Yeah, they were a pest. Now, of course, they're all automatic, and if you burn the toast now, well, it's because the thing malfunctions.
Or user error.
Yes, or you've set it too hot.
Yes. I guess we should have the important conversation, Pete, about... We're in the museum, so the museum's obviously open again. When can people come and how do they go about it?
Well, at the moment we open from 10 o'clock till 4 on Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays. And usually there's somebody comes here on Saturdays and opens at 10 o'clock and stays till just after lunch, about 2 o'clock. That's in case we pick up any weekenders. The rest of the time, due to shortage of volunteers, we have to be closed. But always in the summer months, in normal tourist times, we try and open 5 days a week instead of just three, in the hopes that we'll pick up some tourists. And it's usually pretty successful. Just now, because of the virus lockdown, we not only don't have any tourists, we don't have anybody much coming, even the locals who normally support us. haven't been showing because we've been legally we've had to shut anyway, but now we're legally open.
So now that you're opening in, I mean, you obviously know your stuff about the history of the region. Are there people who can show guests through and talk through some of the stuff that's here, or how does it work?
Well, usually it's left to the person on the bench here, the reception person, to give them a bit of a spiel. We give them a little brochure which tells them a bit about the museum so they can take it home and read it at their leisure. But, yeah, we like to have a yarn to our guests and tell them a few stories about objects that we have here. We have, for instance, the works of the Evershed Clock, Memorial Clock, sitting there in the lobby, just over there. The Evershed Clock was built in 1930 as a memorial to Dr. Montague Frederick Evershed, who was something of a secular saint as far as a medico in Bega. They thought so much of him that the citizenry voluntarily raised £450 during the recession, mind you, the Great Recession in the 1930s. They raised that amount of money and built a memorial clock to him, which still stands in the town to this day. A couple of years ago, the mechanism started to play up and the clock wasn't going. So the local council decided to spend $20,000 and had four crystal-controlled clocks behind each face, or established behind each face in the memorial clock. I happened to be walking past and saw them removing the works, and so I said, could the museum have them? A day or two later, a utility pulled up outside and dumped the works on the floor. They're quite heavy. And disappeared. 3 weeks later, we not only had it going, we mounted it in a glass case, and as you can see, the pendulum's been ticking away ever since, and the clock, if it had a dial, we didn't get the dial, so if it had a dial, though, it'd be keeping pretty good time, as it did for 85 years.
That's amazing. You obviously rely on volunteers. Can people make a donation to help or anything?
We're always pleased to receive donations. We sometimes get some quite handsome ones from not only from passers-by, but from locals. We do depend on volunteers. We don't have any paid personnel here. And, we scratch along as best we can, but we always feel it's worth preserving our past. There's a lot of interesting stuff in here, something like 30,000 items. And I think there hasn't been a day when I've come down here on duty that I haven't found something I didn't know was here.
So you learn something every day?
You learn something every day.
All right, Pete, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Peter Rogers is the current president of Bega's Historical Society. You'll find him in the front entrance of Bega's Pioneers Museum from about 10 o'clock every Monday morning. Indie Media recognises the Yuin people as the traditional owners of this land and pays respects to elders, past, present and emerging. You've been listening to The Local Update, a podcast looking at local issues, events and personalities from around the Bega Valley. My name's Indy Wood. indymedia.com.au is the place to go if you'd like to find more info about any of the episodes, find previous episodes, of course. And don't forget you can subscribe on iTunes or any other podcast provider. This is The Local Update. We have a new episode out every Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock and look forward to your company every week, of course. My name's Indy Wood, and for now, we'll say goodbye.